morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to Michael Holzscheiter from the Church of Beethoven. Right now, I have three residents from the Santa Fe Art Institute Residency Program. This is becoming somewhat of a tradition. We have people on about once a month right before the open studios, which are, in fact, tonight at the Santa Fe Art Institute, which is on the campus of the College of Santa Fe, right here in Santa Fe. It's 5:30. There's refreshments and all sorts of good things. And I'd like first to welcome Ellen Schneppel. She's an anthropologist, and her specialty is French Caribbean Creole language and culture. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be here.
It's wonderful to have you. It's such incredibly interesting work that you do. First of all, what is Creole? We're going to talk about French Creole, but what does the word Creole mean?
Okay. It's a very interesting question, and actually it's quite hard to answer because there are a variety of different definitions for Creole. First of all, it refers to the people, and it was a term that came to us through actually Spanish etymology from a term called criollo back in the 16th century.
Which is still used today.
Absolutely, yes, in Spanish America and also the Spanish Caribbean. But it comes from the verb criar, which means to rear or to breed, and the diminutive criollo referred to the children of the white settlers or Spanish settlers in the colonies.
So if you were a white settler, you came from Spain, lived in, you know, whatever, Colombia or Peru or Ecuador, and you had a child with another Spanish person, that would be a Creole child.
Right.
Criollo.
I think it probably came to be more in the Hispanic Caribbean in the beginning with the early colonization of that area, the Dominican Republic, and so forth. And then in the following century, it was sort of Gallicized, and the term Creole came out of Criollo because it meant that with the French Empire building, the French would come in and settle in areas, and then their offspring would be called Creoles because they had been born in the islands. So it was to differentiate the population that was born in the islands from those that came from Europe or the metropole.
So it really wasn't a racial designation at all?
Well, in the beginning, it was used primarily to refer to the white offspring of the settlers, and then actually it came to be expanded to the population of color as well. And it turns out that in that semantic change, it was began to be used as sort of an adjective, and people would refer to the enslaved population as being neg creole or neg bossal. And the neg creole were the slaves who had been born in the islands, whereas the neg bossal were those who had come over from Africa and hadn't been seasoned yet. And then over time, the designation as an adjective came to refer to the population of color. So, and I think I also wanted to point out to you that it changes over time and space. So if you have people listening from Louisiana or other parts of the Indian Ocean, they probably won't agree with my definition. But it's a semantic issue that changes over time and space within the islands in the Caribbean, Indian Ocean, and Latin America.
Yeah. So where is French Caribbean Creole as a language spoken?
Well, it's spoken in a number of islands. It's spoken in Martinique and Guadeloupe, and also in French Guiana on the tip of South America. It's still spoken in Louisiana, because at one point Louisiana was part of French, was a French colony. And there are also two other islands in the Caribbean, St. Lucia and Dominica, that have French Creoles, and that is from an earlier period of time when they were controlled by the French and later became British and now are independent.
Good heavens.
And then you flip over to the Indian Ocean and you have Reunion Island, which is still a French overseas department where French Creole is spoken. You have Mauritius, which is an independent former British colony that where there is Creole spoken, and also the Seychelles. So it's largely island populations.
Everybody who's listening right now has to go to Wikipedia and figure out where these places even are. I had to look up Mauritius the other day, which is near Madagascar. But anyway.
Right.
Well, so how different is the French Creole? First of all, what is the French Creole language, and how different is it from one place to another in the, for example, the places that you just talked about?
Right. In the literature, scholars have always said that the languages were mutually intelligible, that if you went from one French island to another, for instance, if you went from Martinique to Haiti to the Seychelles, you could understand it. But over time, people have realized that that's not true. What you understand is if the scholars in these islands are speaking French Creole, you basically can understand it because their Creole is very much infused with a lot of French terms, new terms that maybe Creole has not been able to adapt to or, you know, invent new terms. And so a lot of French...
You mean like iPod?
Actually, yes, and I think computer, you know, like ordinateur. Sometimes it's ordinateur in Creole. The phonology of Creole absorbs the French word. But if you travel around to these islands and you visit a lot of the peasants, that's where you're going to have difficulty. I learned Guadeloupean Creole. I feel very familiar speaking with people in that. But when I went to Haiti in February this year, I had a lot of difficulty. It's one of the most difficult of the what I call dialects of Creole to learn, simply because with the independence of Haiti in 1804, the contact between the French language and Creole was not abruptly ended, but because so many of the people in Haiti spoke Creole and had very little access to French, that Creole has stayed in many cases purer than the ones in the French islands, because with the influence of metropolitan France and now being overseas departments of France, you get Argo coming into the Creole, you get Martiniquans and Guadeloupeans who are over in Paris, they come back after a migratory experience and they have new words that are infused in the Creole. So the language is constantly changing.
What are the roots of the Creole language besides French?
Well, okay, now, it's very interesting. The roots of Creole are actually... The particular Creole I know is a French lexically based Creole. So the root, a lot of the vocabulary comes through French with words that come from Carib Indian language, and also there are some African terms as well from different African languages. The structure of the language many people feel is closer to a lot of different African languages such as Fon. But in my work, I'm not dealing so much with those issues of the origin of Creole and the structure and morphology of the language. I'm much more interested in the social use of the language and how people use it in performance and in speaking and in proverbs and things like that. Sort of the living language as opposed to scholarly study of texts. And
One wonders, and you'll in a moment speak to us at least a little bit in Creole so we can get a feel for the sound of it. But, for example, we have in both political activism and academia this huge, you know, now decades-old movement of multiculturalism. Has the Creole language and the people who speak it taken more pride, national pride or regional pride in their language? I imagine that it was before, you know, what, the 70s or 60s, probably a looked down upon.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'm so glad you asked that question. For a long, long time, Creoles, not just Guadeloupean Creole, but Haitian Creole, Mauritian Creole, were thought to be deformed varieties of French. And this really continued to be believed by not scholars, but also by the local people themselves who spoke the language. Many people were afraid to speak it in schools. They were not allowed to speak it in schools, oftentimes not in church services. The media was exclusively in French. And then that changed with departmentalization in 1946 in Guadeloupe and Martinique. And I'm speaking more about their cases because I know that region so well. The fact that these islands were integrated in politically and economically into France meant that they lost a lot culturally. And over time, they believed that with this loss of cultural autonomy, one of the things that was threatened was their Creole language. And in the 1970s, a nationalist movement in both islands began to look at Creole as perhaps the key symbol that they wanted to use as an emblem for national identity and for cultural pride. So I came on the scene around that period of time when there was very little written about the language, on the language, very few printed materials in the language, and now it's just completely been overwhelmed with writers, writing in poetry and novels, singers and bands like Kassav are singing in Creole, and their lyrics are printed on their album covers or their CD covers in Creole.
Where's Kassav from?
They're based in Paris, but the musicians are both from Martinique and Guadeloupe.
Uh-huh.
So they've spent a lot of time in what they call the metropole.
Yeah. Right. The metropole being France.
The hexagon, they usually say. Yeah.
Now, is, for example, are advertising and media using Creole as well?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's very interesting. Perhaps not before the 1980s, but with the 1980s, there was a tendency to feel that Creole had really been appropriated by the nationalists, and there was a little bit of a movement to bring it back into sort of center stage so that everyone could have it, and that meant that advertisers were using it, and again, it was for commercial reasons. You could sell soap, healthcare measures, you know, if you needed to get a doctor's visit or something, and
right.
they would announce it over the radio. So it became both commercially and culturally viable on the radio, in newspapers and so forth. The one problem is that it's much easier to understand it and use it orally. Writing in Creole is still somewhat difficult for people, and if you publish your novel in Creole, chances are it's not going to be a huge success, because
right.
your captive audience that will read it is probably a group of intellectuals, writers, artists, journalists,
not the common people
yes.
who speak Creole. Now, unfortunately, we could talk about this for the whole show, and we want to talk to some of the other residents who are also here with us at the table, but you are doing something very interesting, which is you are using your work as an anthropologist to write memoir and creative nonfiction addressing some of these subjects that come up in Creole. And I was wondering if you could read a little bit from one of the short stories, or I guess, would you call this a short story?
Or? It's a short story, yes.
But it's real.
It's real.
This happened
yes,
to you.
Yes, it happened to me. I call it creative nonfiction because I'm actually writing dialogue in Creole, and I don't remember the dialogue, so I'm creating it myself from actual experiences.
But it's close to your memory of what actually
absolutely,
happened.
Absolutely, absolutely.
We're talking to Ellen Schneppel. She's an anthropologist, and she will be reading tonight at the Santa Fe Art Institute Open Studios at 5:30 in the afternoon.
Shall I start? Okay. This is actually a short piece called A Rite of Passage. And I have just arrived in Guadeloupe. It's 1984. It's my second visit to the island, and I'm there for 2 years of research, and I'm on the beach with a fisherman, and I'm trying to learn Creole. Qui noao? I asked hesitantly of the burly suntan Santois fisherman as he repaired his fish traps on the beach in the lazy afternoon tropical sun while shaded by an almond tree. Shirtless and wearing a straw hat or bakwa, the man was barefoot, in torn work pants that were rolled up to his calves and hung below his protruding gut. Poverty clung to him like the tentacles of an octopus to its prey. Etienne, he replied, announcing his name proudly, while seemingly amused by my accent as I tried to speak Creole. What brings you to Guadeloupe, to our little fishing village, Saint-François? He asked in his native tongue. I'm here to learn Creole. I want to parler Creole con vous, you know, to speak Creole just like you.
Creole.
It's patois. Broken French, it's not a language, he said as if wanting to discourage my enthusiasm. I had heard this refrain before from Guadeloupians of all social classes, young and old, men and women, city and rural dwellers, Indians and Creoles. How could they think otherwise when living on an island that had been under French domination since 1635, where school was taught in French and TV and radio programs were all broadcast in the refined Gallic tongue? Few of the San Franciscans spoke of their ancestors from Africa, or how in the forced transplantation across the Middle Passage to the Caribbean, their languages had been lost and a new mixed or hybrid language, Creole, was born. Many didn't know its history, let alone their own. But back in 1981, only one radio program, Pikenga, on Radio Guadeloupe, aired broadcasts in Creole for listening enjoyment on lazy Saturday afternoons. Few written materials existed in the language, and when writing in Creole, people wrote spontaneously in their own way, following no apparent system or rules. After a pause, the silence was broken. Creole's not good for much, but jokes, insults, vulgarity, Etienne said, obviously with some ambivalence. How can you say it's not a language when you speak it every day, when it's your mother tongue, I countered. Langue maman, he corrected me, emphasizing the nasalized vowels that are so typical of Guadeloupean Creole. So why would someone from the metropole want to learn our language? You speak French. That should be enough. It will get you a good job. What do you want with Creole? It won't get you work, he emphasized as he looked down at his torn bamboo and chicken wire fish trap. But I'm not from the metropole.
Kikote usoti?
He asked, curious about my origins. I'm American.
American?
That's different.
Ah, c'est mon ami.
You're one of us, he responded in delight. From that day on, we were friends.
And so then skip forward a page because I want to go ahead and start there.
My afternoons with Etienne were mutually beneficial. He had female companionship, and I improved fluidity in his language. The only problem was that our daily afternoon ritual of Creole conversation began to attract every straggler on the beach, older men, unemployed boys, jobeurs, and voyous. Like the roots of the mangrove, unemployment stretched out its limbs from one end of the island to the other, and savings were as meager as a cow in Grande Terre during the dry season. The male bystanders were curious about my relationship with a married fisherman, who'd fathered numerous children, including timoun duor, or outside children in Creole parlance. According to a local proverb, on pêche coquet bien, a fisherman makes good love. I soon became fascinated with the progressive verb form ka in Creole that was used to show continuous or habitual action and wondered why the Creole verb coquet, to make love, to copulate, was one of the few verbs that didn't need this marker. Did frequent practice make it redundant? One day, as I was seated beside Etienne, as he toiled, an old man leaned over and began to proposition me in front of the crowd.
Une belle femme comme vous doit mettre quoi dans le couche à moi.
A beautiful woman like you must spend the night in my bed, he remarked. I didn't know how to handle his advances. I didn't want to hurt his feelings and say no. After all, I was to live in the community for the rest of the summer. How would he handle rejection? What would the others think of me, a female not succumbing to a man's sexual charms, albeit from someone a bit tattered in appearance and ravaged by time in the local rum agricole? Then all of a sudden I blurted out in Creole,
Monsieur, d'après moi, à l'âge au, coco, pas qu'à marcher encore.
Or quite literally that at his advanced age, perhaps he couldn't get it up anymore. I was amazed by my bravado, as well as the perfect turn of the Creole phrases. A spirit must have entered my body and taken over my voice, for never, never would I have the nerve to say such a thing, especially as a foreign visitor trying to learn the local cultural norms. The men on the beach burst out laughing. Bellies jiggled. They sucked their teeth in approval. Perhaps the poor old man was indeed impotent, for in these small villages, sexual reputations traveled widely. But if not, he surely didn't call my bluff. I soon learned that sexual innuendo and banter were appreciated by the town folk. It was part of daily language play in a culture where life was hard and oral dexterity valued.
Ellen Schneffel is an anthropologist specializing in French Creole. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, you're so welcome.
Let's turn now to Dominic McLaughlin, who is a poet and teacher of creative writing, and he is also a resident at the Santa Fe Art Institute. Welcome.
Hi, I'm Mary Charlotte.
It's wonderful to have you here.
Thank you very much.
Now, you've come over all the way from London to be a resident here, and I was thinking, why don't we start out with a poem and then talk from there?
That's a pleasure.
By the way, Dominic is an award-winning poet. He won second place in the National Poetry Competition in 2005 that was for the whole United Kingdom, so that's a great honor.
I'd like to read a poem that was awarded a prize in that competition.
Oh, great.
I do wish someone would ask me to the races with him stroke her. Ridiculous to think, at 23, I used to wear a hot pink T-shirt and one dangly black earring to the typing school in Mayfair. I was the only guy in the class, except for one man 3 weeks ahead of me, with a very fast WPM. Key learning strategy. Don't look at the keyboard. Look at the facsimile of the keyboard we have placed on your desk. Helpful tip, keep both feet on the ground. By week two, we had to type full sentences. I must buy a new pair of black stockings. When we graduated with capable fingers on a gorgeous spring day, a classmate asked me, by the bus stop at Speaker's Corner, if I would go to the races with her. She had an encyclopedic knowledge of bloodstock and conditions of the turf. I said no, thinking these things inevitably lead to trouble with one's girlfriend. Little men in silk, hot flanks in the winner's enclosure, peering through binoculars, mouthing an unlikely name from the card.
Dominic McLaughlin. Now, I read that poem a number of times, and now you're reading it aloud, and one of the things that struck me is that there's a story there,
yes.
And the story is behind the scenes. You have to read between the lines to get it.
Yes. There is a story. I suppose one way of reading it is that it's a meditation on the difference between typing and writing. I was talking about this with a fellow resident at SFAI this morning, and I think once you start writing, really writing a poem, you have to think of all the messiness of desire and all the complications of being human, and typing is something different. Typing is more like copying.
So, what is... Well, you're here at the Santa Fe Art Institute now. You've been writing poems for a very long time. Do you find that when you go to a new place that's completely different from, say, London, that it fills you with a different kind of writing?
Yeah. One thing that I've enjoyed so much being here is I started out studying philosophy, and you have a wonderful college here, St. John's College, and I've been inspired lately, and certainly while I've been here, to think about the links between poetry and philosophy.
And say more, as we say at St. John's, can you say more about that?
Well, one way into this was to think whether you can ask questions in poems, like what is beauty or what is knowledge? And I love the way that we can try and address such philosophical questions, but at the same time still try and make what we're writing beautiful or sound good or full of ideas.
When you say that, the first thing that comes to mind is that in philosophy you inquire into what is beauty and what is knowledge, and in poetry you kind of do it.
You kind of do it, exactly. So... it's hard I can't put myself forward as a philosopher, as a professional philosopher, but I do enjoy reading it. And one thing I've been doing whilst I've been here is reading a lot of Lucretius. And maybe Santa Fe is one of the not so common places where Lucretius is well known, as he's on the syllabus at St. John's. But in the poem that I'm going to read at the... Open studio tonight, I try and have a bit of a dialogue with Lucretius, because he's such an exciting writer. He's telling us in his book, The Way Things Are, everything he knows. He's telling us about the weather, about the senses, about everything, but he's trying to say it in an engaging way too. So in my writing I've tried to talk back to him a bit, and talk across the years, if you like.
I love that there was a time when somebody could, with a straight face, write a book called The Way Things Are.
And me too. I love the enthusiasm that it involves. You know, I'm just going to now talk about everything.
Yeah, as if one could know everything.
Yeah, and that it's in a poem maybe slightly addresses the fact that we can't really know everything, and that maybe... putting it in poetic form is as if to say, well, let's just sing about it. We've tried to find out as much as we can, and now let's make it into a song.
Do you want to read that poem now or save it for tonight?
I wonder if I could save that one for tonight.
Yeah, let's hear a different one then. Your choice.
But I would like to read another that actually links to SFAI in a different way, in that it's... talks about a press, an artist's press, and it's simply called press.
Now, by artist press, you mean a printing press that prints art books?
Exactly, or helps you do etchings.
Okay. Oh, that kind of press, right.
Yeah. They're great big things, and one of the reasons I like the image is it helped me think about the weight that we carry, in a good way, not that it drags us down, but the weight that we carry and the bulk that goes with being an artist of any kind. press. For its sake, we only move house when we're sure. This anchor, dead weight, make weight, flight, which keeps us steady as ballast should. Each part has to be singly packed and counted. The heaviest is lifted only when we can achieve the right combination of steadiness and flow. Dispatched ahead in its own van, it keeps a weather eye on any change of scene. Then, at each stop, etchings gradually accrue. For the near immovable, it travels light, carries no excess baggage, will go with others after we are gone. Century traveller, cold metal spinning wheel, hard case cast in its own mould. This beast is charged with making our deepest impressions. On arrival, we like to be held, to kiss, to touch, to stroke. It lies still, a steady injunction. Press.
We're talking to poet Dominic McLaughlin. When you write a poem, for example, if I'm sitting here thinking, what does this mean, a steady injunction? Is that something that you can explain what you mean, or is it that we as readers have to keep reading it until it seeps into our head and we figure it out for ourselves?
Well, it might be a bit of a dodge, but I was recently reading that Wallace Stevens replied to a reader when asked what one of his poems meant, saying that the meaning wasn't the most important thing in the poem, that it was only one of the things. But I can certainly say that the word steady does reappear. That's, I think, the third time it's appeared there. And in this poem, I was thinking about how we can keep steady when we're on the move and when we want to keep making art of some kind. It does stand there as a calling, an invitation, and something that it's not possible, perhaps, to get away from.
So one of the things that you have been doing at the Santa Fe Art Institute is having conversations among writers and poets and talking about, I mean, writers and artists, poets,
yeah.
Writers, artists, visual artists, and talking about some of the relationships between these media.
Yeah, we had especially a discussion last Sunday, and one of the artists about poetry and painting, and one of the artists, Jesse, who's with us here today, picked out from one of the poems we were discussing a line from John Ashbery, and the line was, or part of the line was, "We were a seesaw." Again, about meaning, it's not easy to say what that means. We were a seesaw. But it's just playing with language in a way that an artist may play with paint. And that if we focus on and slowly read a poem, we can pick out something like that and see how it's about balance and it's about playing with sound. So it's been great fun, informally and also in a more studied way, to talk to the artists at SFAI.
And Jessica Maloney is the third artist who is with us right now from the Santa Fe Art Institute. She's part of the residency program there. And once again, the open studios are tonight at 5:30. And maybe this is a good time to we can sort of all join in together, but to talk about your work a little bit. You're a professor of art and an artist who does photography and what you call sequential photography.
Yes.
So you'll film, you'll make still photographs of something that happens in just a few seconds, and so you'll have a kind of stop motion sequence of events.
Sequential photography is something I've been interested in for a while now. I started it in grad school, which is about 5 years ago, and I've picked it back up again here in Santa Fe. So it's been interesting to kind of come back to what I know.
And so what is learned or gained, or what are the artistic possibilities when you do that kind of sequential photography? I mean, we think about Edward Muybridge,
mm-hmm.
as perhaps the earliest practitioner of that?
Yeah, definitely. He's been an influence on me. I took a class in grad school called The Art of Sequence in Photography, and we studied Muybridge, and we studied Hockney, and we studied various films and whatnot. And I think, you know, studying the sequence allows you to look at the little moments that maybe are overlooked in a whole event. You can kind of like take a step back and break those moments of time up into smaller parts that you can then analyze.
And what's strange about it is that the event itself can be quite uninteresting, but when you break it up, suddenly it becomes more interesting. You know, somebody walking across the room or something like that.
Yeah. You know, I came in to SFAI with one phrase in mind, and that was holding patterns. And so I've been trying not to overanalyze my work, but instead go in and create the work and then go back in and analyze what it means. So the only thing that's really been kind of a in my mind was the idea of holding patterns.
So what is a holding pattern?
Holding patterns, technically I was thinking about the aviation holding patterns. When you're in flight and you're going to land somewhere, but the landing strip isn't ready for you to land yet, they have this very exact pattern that the planes have to fly in. It's a racetrack pattern that they have to circle in. So it's a repetitive racetrack pattern that they use when they're waiting to land. And so I've taken that holding pattern idea and applied it to psychological patterns.
What's a psychological example of a holding pattern?
Well, I've been thinking about that, you know, quite a bit, and because it's a term that I was just kind of tossing around in my head, and then, of course, you have to figure out, well, what does that term mean? And you had mentioned maybe, like, walking across a room, you know, how that's a very mundane action. One of the pieces that I've created here is a diptych titled Split Decision, and it's a figure walking in two different directions. The first frame is a figure walking out of the scene in one direction, and the next frame, she's walking out of the scene in the other direction. And it's kind of that split decision, so it's an in-between space, or that transitional phase where you could go one way or another. And that is the type of holding pattern that I'm trying to explore in a psychological sense.
So when you are you photographing other people who just happen to be around the Art Institute?
Yes, I've had some volunteers. So the first person I photographed was actually on your show in July, Alana, and she was a similar body type to me and you know, same age, and so I kind of felt like I could relate to her figure. And so I typically use the female figure in my work just because it's something I'm familiar with and I can relate to that psychology, and so I chose her as my figure to use for most of the images.
So let's go back to this question, and anybody can join in. How are you, for example, in a residency program like this, influenced by writers, or in general, influenced by writing?
Well, you know, what's wonderful is having all the feedback. And there's actually one phrase I wanted to bring up, actually a couple. There was one writer who writes screenplays, and he's a resident right now, and when he was talking about my work, he was talking about it in theatrical terms. So kind of he would look at a piece and say, oh, this is about, you know, entrances and exits.
Right.
When I wouldn't have thought of that. There's another artist resident right now named Joy, and she was describing, she had looked at some of my pieces previously, and she came up to me the other day and said, you know, I had a moment where my eyes teared up the other day. And as I was looking through my tears at the world around me, I thought of your work. She said, you know, you have this kind of soft focus and it's sad but beautiful. And she really wanted to just relay that to me and say, you know, that's looking through tears is how she viewed my work.
Very interesting.
So, yeah, you get all these insights that you wouldn't get if you were just working in, you know, a room by yourself.
What about you, Dominic McLaughlin? Any thing that has been added by having visual artists around you?
I was fortunate to be invited to the studio of one artist. And, yeah, it's just the challenge of trying to respond authentically to something that's just been made. And the artist, Donna Ruff, was invited me to just respond without having that art historical background. And hopefully it's something where we can learn from each other. I've also learned a lot from the other writers at SFAIM, and we've informally got together each week and shared work. And this is also, it gives you a slight deadline, but it also...
Which is always good.
Which is always good. But it also gives you a bit of feedback.
Dominic McLaughlin, Jessica Maloney, and Ellen Schneppel are residents at the Santa Fe Art Institute, and once again tonight at 5:30, there will be an open studios where these three and many more artists will be showing their work and engaging in conversation with whoever shows up for the activities and refreshments. For more information, you can call 424-5050. And you can also look at sfai.org. We're going to take a little break right now, and when we come back, we'll be talking about the Church of Beethoven. So stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Michael Holzscheiter. He is here to talk about the Church of Beethoven. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. So this coming Saturday at 10:30 in the morning at El Museo Cultural in Santa Fe on Paseo de Peralta is going to be your next event. This has been going on, I guess, for the month of August. Why morning concerts?
Well, the idea started actually about half a year ago in Albuquerque, where Felix Wurman, who was a cellist with the New Mexico Symphony, had this idea to bring classical music back to the people, bring it on a more personal level. And he came up with a crazy name, Church of Beethoven.
Why Church of Beethoven?
Well, he just had this idea. Jerry Seinfeld once in a show said, why do they call it Crepe Nuts? They're no Crepe nor Nuts here. And so this is really not a church.
But there is Beethoven.
But there's Beethoven. Rarely, but occasionally we do Beethoven.
Right, like this coming Saturday.
Yeah. So, and it's very successful in Albuquerque. It's a very small space they have. It's an old gas station in the Barreras district. So you literally sit with a musician. So you've never been that close to a quartet or even to a larger ensemble. And some people have been going down there almost weekly, and we decided this is something Santa Fe is actually lacking. We have a lot of classical music, we have a lot of offerings, but this is something completely different. For everybody to enjoy, it's a free concert. They just pass around a bus basket at the end and ask for donations. But if you feel you can afford it and you like the show, you help. And if you just want to listen to the music, but you really don't have the means to buy $50 concert tickets, you still can come.
And so there's a suggested donation of $15, but people can pay whatever they want. There's also poetry at the event this weekend, the poems of Lisa Gill.
Yes, that's actually a regular, and that makes it a little bit more in the direction of the church again. We have different things going in parallel. We have the classical music, we have poetry, and we have a number of resident poets, like Elisa Gill is one from Albuquerque. But we also have poets which are just traveling through the area or take part in one of the workshops or things like that, and they will come. And sometimes the poets have a very close relationship to the music which is played. Sometimes they're completely disconnected. Some are traditional poets which were dug up in the literature again. Some are brand new works by the resident poets. But they always give you something to think about. I think that's where we come close to church, that people start reflecting on themselves and thinking about what this is all about. And so the additional thing to the church is actually we always have a 1 or 2 minute of silence right in the middle. We don't have an intermission, but everybody is quiet and just thinks, hopefully.
Or absorbs the vibration
yeah,
around them.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Are you a musician yourself?
No, I'm not. I'm a physicist, actually, by training. And I used to work in Los Alamos for 16 years, but I'm now too young and early retired and indulge myself in cancer research. But I love classical music like many of my colleagues do. And we have known Felix for a number of years. And when I heard about this, we decided to help him to spread the word around New Mexico.
Tell us more about Felix.
Well, we're not that closely related with him, so I'm really not sure what I should tell you. I don't have his CV here right now, but he's a cellist. Yes.
Felix Wurmann. Is he German,
yeah.
Like you?
No, he's not German.
Okay.
But the name sounds German, but could come from anywhere else, too. And he has been with the symphony for many, many years in New Mexico. He always had ideas to break outside of the concert hall. And sometime he had a series set up which was called the Domus concert, and they had a portable geodesic dome they traveled around the country with and played concerts in it. He also likes the idea to mix with the people, with the audience, so that's why he came up with the idea of the espresso artists who are there before and after the show, and there's sort of free coffee drinks, cappuccino, lattes, also tea for people who like tea. And so you get a lot of chance to actually speak with the musicians. They don't go backstage to tune up the instruments. They do it right there while you're sitting there and talking to them. It's a very close and personal experience. And we're trying to do the same here in the Museo Cultural. We have to get the room really packed to make that happen. The first concert we had was just 2 weeks ago, and it was a very good success for the very first time. We had about 100 people, a little bit less than 100 people there, but we can see 200, and we really want to fill it. So people run into the cellist and vacuum out of his tune for a moment when that happens, because that is really what... I think classical music started like that. If you think back in history, Mozart was a rock star of his times. He was an entertainer at parties. It was a raucous crowd, which we don't propose we want to have here. We want to have people be quiet when the music plays, but
right.
Still... It should be an entertainment and not something like an idol on the stage you just are in awe about.
So Mozart was a rock star of his time. Did the common people, did the peasants, so to speak, go and hear Mozart's music?
Well, I wasn't there, so I really can't tell. But from the character of what different books and movies portray, I think he was very well known in the community. And he probably played... on the street. Like one example which actually comes out of the Church of Beethoven was not too long ago we had a violinist there who actually played on a Stradivari.
Really?
And the story of the instrument was this Stradivari was originally owned as first owner by Paganini. But Paganini was such a poor guy at the time that he sold his Stradivari behind Stradivari's back. For money, for food.
Right.
And, I mean, nowadays we think these musicians were these great people, but they were just regular starving artists like we have
just
today.
Just like everybody else.
Like another example how classical musicians behave. Bach, who is a strong part of our program sometimes, when he was a young musician, and that story I got from the concert master of the Santa Fe Symphony many years ago, he... was a concertmaster in a church somewhere in the former East Germany, and they have a statue standing there with Bach in his 20s with a dagger in his hand, commemorating the event that he actually accused one of the people in the orchestra that he was, in the English translation, you call him a sissy goat bassoonist.
A what?
A sissy goat bassoonist, whatever that means.
Whatever that means.
And that guy actually jumped up and challenged Bach, and so they went outside and they threw their weapons and they fought it out.
Oh my goodness.
And nowadays you think of Bach with a wide wig and a
right.
heavy-set guy. No, he wasn't like that. And I think we want to bring the music somewhat back to that level and have a good mixture. A very nice concert they gave not too long ago was for David Felberg, the concertmaster here of the Santa Fe Symphony, rearranged Ravel's Bolero for 14 individual instruments. So each instrument was playing the role of a whole voice in the Bolero. And I have seen amazing concerts of the Bolero, actually one in the National Symphony in Madrid in Spain many years ago. But this was the first time it was completely different. By the halfway through the piece, the entire audience was swaying back and forth with the music, and people weren't sitting still and staring anymore. They were taking part in it. I mean, it was short of people started singing it.
It's funny. I went to a music festival last weekend, and one of the things that I was so struck by is that I and virtually everybody else there was in an altered state, some kind of state of passionate ecstasy in an engagement in this music. And I don't know to what extent that is happening in classical music concerts. When I look around at the faces of people in classical music concerts, I don't see it.
That's correct. That's correct, actually. It's sometimes sad when we go to a concert here in Santa Fe or anywhere in the world. People are very formal, they dress up nicely, and then they sit still and have themselves being, swamped by the music. But they don't take part, neither emotionally nor physically. And so here, we really encourage the participation of the audience. We had times where we had, for instance, a guitarist coming, and one piece was we all sang Bob Dylan songs together. Everybody, the whole 150 people. One time we had a bass from the Metropolitan Opera here who actually also performed here in Santa Fe at the first concert. But at the earlier time, what he did, he split the audience in sections and said, you are the trombones, you are the violins, you are the brass pieces, you are the cello. And then he gave each of those sections one line to sing, and then he directed the whole concert. And he sang along whenever he felt like the violins were too weak. His voice was going there. When he felt the trombones were too weak, he jumped over there. And it was like a 5 or 10 minute piece, but everybody felt like they were part of it.
The musicians and the audience
the
both,
and the
one
audience.
Transfers over
right.
to the other.
Mm-hmm.
Well, unfortunately, it's time to go. Michael Holzscheiter is with the Church of Beethoven, and the show in Santa Fe is this coming Saturday, the 23rd of August, at 10:30 at El Museo Cultural, which is at 1615 Paseo de Peralta in Santa Fe. For more information, you can call 505-307-9647, 307-9647. There's also a website. You can Google Church of Beethoven, and you can also come for tea and coffee from 9:30 in the morning on. Thank you so much for being here, Michael.
Thank you very much, and I just want to add on, there are also a lot of concerts on YouTube. If you want to look at anything, go to YouTube,
Excellent.
churchofbeethoven.org.
Excellent. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan features the monthly New Orleans Hour. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Hasta mañana. We'll see you later.